Welcome back to Issues Etc. This is Hour 2. We're going to be continuing our conversation with Dr. Jeff Waltz, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, talking about things political and getting his assessment of the Bush presidency here in the final part of that conversation. Feel free to join us at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, in this hour, we had originally scheduled Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief and Human Care to come in and talk about, ironically, why do bad things happen. Earlier in the day, he was in a car accident, banged up his head a little bit, and although I think he was valiantly trying to come into the studio, from what I could observe of my producer's conversation with him, he's not going to come into the studio today. He is doing fine. You want to keep him and his family in your prayers. There's also someone else riding in the car with him, and of course the person that ran into them as well. We want to keep all of them in our prayers. Matt Harrison will rejoin us at some future time to talk about that very question. Why do bad things happen? In the rest of the program, here's our lineup. It remains unchanged. In the stead of Matt Harrison, we're going to be talking with an author of the book called Darwin's Proof, and it is written by Cornelius Hunter. We've had him on the program before. He wrote a book before called Darwin's God: The Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Failures of Darwin's Theory of Evolution. Will be the topic for the remainder of the program when we're finished talking about politics with Dr. Jeff Waltz. Cornelius Hunter is author of that book called Darwin's Proof: The Triumph of Religion Over Science. In the third hour of the program, we'll be talking first with Dr. Mike Horton, co-host of the national radio program called The White Horse Inn, about postmodernism and pop culture. He's written an article in the most recent edition of Modern Reformation magazine called Pop Goes Pop, Postmodernism. And then Craig Parton will join us for the final half hour. He's author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for August, titled The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. Law, Evidence, and the Defense of the Christian Faith will be the topic in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Dr. Waltz, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's turn our attention to two big questions that came up recently vis-a-vis the economy and the Bush administration. One is the Fed having to basically saying, we're not going to cut interest rates anymore. That's kind of become a rarity with the Fed of late. What power does the Fed have, and Alan Greenspan in particular, when it comes to the economy? You said before, presidents don't really control the thing. Does the Fed?
Well, certainly the Fed has more control, arguably, and of course the president does nominate and does select essentially members to the Fed, but it is the Fed that does put into practice some fiscal and monetary policy, and one way to try and energize the economy is to drop the overnight rate on funds that banks pay the central bank for loans. And that's the 1% rate that we've been hearing about, that's been dropped all the way down to, well, almost 0.1%. And of course the idea is if we have a lower interest rate, it'll be cheaper for businesses especially to borrow money and to produce things and to really get the productivity going. A couple of reasons, I'm not an economist, but the rate is so low right now, there's really not much room to maneuver. And also, it's the Fed's feeling, or at least some of the Fed's feeling, that we're going to see some of the fruits of a lower rate and perhaps of the Bush tax plan either later this year or into 2004. So we don't want to overshoot the goal, as it were, and we want to wait and hopefully see an economic recovery occurring. And these are really the two ways to affect the economy, either through a tax policy or through an interest rate policy. And of course, economists will disagree on which one's more effective or more immediate, but those are the two mechanisms that are used. And again, a lot of people say it's much more effective to lower the interest rates because it's more immediate. As far as a tax break, you know, there have been lots of stories on whether people are spending that, you know, the $400 per child. Are they spending it on getting the economy going? Are they saving it? Are they paying off a loan? And so, you know, there's a lot of different interpretations on that.
You know, I'll tell you precisely how I spent mine.
Okay.
Okay, I've got two. I got $800 when I came home from vacation waiting for me, which was a nice little surprise.
Yes.
It went right back to pay property taxes on a new car or actually the sales tax on a new car that we had just purchased. So a kind of a tax break that went right back, well, at least to the state, to the Secretary of State.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, someone has said, look, people who need that money are going to find a way to spend it, but that's not necessarily going to help us in the long run. It's going to get spent quick. People who don't need the money, well, they'll probably find a way to spend it too. Can that really stimulate the economy in the way that people are talking about? Or is there a psychological benefit that the president is aiming at more than simply, this is going to boost our economy big?
Yeah, I think you're right, Todd. I think it is more psychological because, as you say, the $400 or $800, it's a one-time, it's a quick kind of payment, and again, it probably doesn't have too much staying power. But it is an attempt, at least, to try and lift the sagging spirits psychologically of the nation, of the citizens, to be more optimistic. Instead of saving their money too much and not spending it and not getting the economy going. So I think you're right. I think it was more psychological.
Now, another big issue for the Bush presidency, especially going into the election, is who is going to replace outgoing Secretary of State Colin Powell? He has promised, along with one of his close deputies, that he will not be back for the second Bush presidency. He says that was the deal all along.
Right. And we heard that report, and then the White House seemed to say, well, that's not final. But I think we can pretty well assume that will be the case unless something changes. And I think the White House has some interesting personnel decisions to make in the lineup, as it were. Clearly, the rising star, who already is a star, Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, could be a natural for that kind of a Secretary of State post. But on the other hand, when you think about 2004, you think about Dick Cheney, will he again be the running mate? Possibly, but on the other hand, possibly not. And others have said Condoleezza Rice would also be a wonderful vice president, bringing some of her skills, her experience, having a woman that high on the ticket certainly couldn't hurt Bush politically or otherwise. So I think the Bush White House has some interesting decisions to make down the road, but they do have, I think, a fairly deep roster from which to draw.
Sounds like they could use two Condoleezza Rices.
Yes, I think they could, yes.
One way that her appointment to state wouldn't seem to make much difference, because Colin Powell is pro-choice and Condoleezza Rice is pro-choice, but if she is tapped for a running mate to replace Dick Cheney in the second one, could that hurt him with his base?
It could. It certainly could. And this is the interesting thing, too, about 2004, and also as a demonstration of, as we know, the changing demographics in the country. I saw a statistic recently that suggested that if the vote were to be held today, based on current trends for how certain ethnic groups voted in 2000, that Bush would not win in 2004 if these groups voted the way they did in 2000, simply because the population has changed so much, even within a 3 or 4 year span, with a growing Latino population. And so that's part of the equation as well, where certainly the pro-choice perspective would not endear Bush to the party, the social conservative faithfuls, definitely. But on the other hand, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that it's going to be a landslide in 2004. As you know, and people talk about 1992 and Bush 1, Bush 41 versus Clinton as kind of a historical parallel. And yeah, there are a lot of differences, but I think that is a lesson that you never know how an election is going to play out until you get closer to that date.
That was my final question, having to do with the announcement several weeks ago that the Latino population in the United States is now the largest minority in the United States. Another news piece I read said that, you know, with a slight majority, Latinos are pro-life when polled, but they don't often vote Republican. And I'm wondering, President Bush made a very valiant effort to try and connect with the Latino voter during 2002. Will he be equally or more successful in 2004?
Yeah, very good question, because this, as we said, growing population, not to say it's monolithic, but as you say, it is generally overall pro-life, pro-family, but unlike other parts of the Republican constituency, it tends to be more supportive of government than a quote-unquote typical Republican would be. So it's not necessarily, certainly there are folks in that crowd, but it's not a tax, a rabid, as it were, a fervid tax-cutting crowd. It's a crowd that wants to see a more moderate level of government services. So I think it's tough to really play that out. I think Bush has been effective in appealing to the Latino communities. He did very well in Texas and did decently in 2000. But I think he needs to continue to reach out with his pro-family agenda, with his pro-life agenda, and as he's mentioned, not embark on any more tax-cutting proposals, because it would seem to me that would not be really popular, well, with some people, and especially with the Latino voting bloc.
Finally, how likely is it in the Democratic field, now nine, that someone else, former Vice President Al Gore, Hillary Rodham Clinton, any one of those, would throw their hat into the ring closer to the primaries and change the whole 2004 landscape?
It is possible. There are still some draft Gore proponents, some advocates out there who, you know, not publicly, of course, not very loudly, but are suggesting that certainly Gore could be the go-to candidate or go-to guy. And of course, we heard Gore being very critical of Bush just recently. That's a possibility. I'd say Hillary Clinton, I finished reading her book, and she seems to be more positioning herself, of course, for a possible run in 08. Unless things really change and unless there isn't a front runner that emerges. So, yeah, certainly that's possible. I guess with Gore, on the one hand, you can say he had the most votes in 2000, but the bottom line was he lost the election. So does the Democratic Party, even if things got to be dire, would they want to bring him back for a rematch with obviously no guarantee of a better performance in 2004?
Dr. Jeff Waltz, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc., and for staying those few extra minutes with us.
Thank you, Todd. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Jeff Waltz is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. We've been talking about things political. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to talk about the scientific, philosophical, and theological failures of Darwin's theory of evolution. Cornelius Hunter is our guest. He's been with us before to talk about his previous book called Darwin's God. He's written a new book called Darwin's Proof, The Triumph of Religion Over Science. He's formerly Senior Vice President of Siegel Technology in Silicon Valley. Cornelius, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start out with something that you begin by saying, that Darwin had it partly right. Everyone acknowledges that evolution occurs in a limited sense. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's very true. You know, when we argue against evolution, we got to be very careful to acknowledge the good parts of it. There's no question that insects gain resistance to insecticides, crops or weeds gain resistance to herbicides, and so forth. In fact, the scientists have done wonders with improving crops, breeding animal husbandry, and increasing the quality of our agriculture in many different ways. And evolutionists will often point to this as a sort of evidence for their theory. So now, while there's a big, big difference between this sort of microevolution and the huge amounts of change that their theory calls for, nonetheless, we should be careful to at least acknowledge that there is something, you know, the Pope said evolution is okay. We should be able to study evolution, and I agree. We don't want to simply rule out evolution as a bad word. It's a good word. We don't want to lose that word from our vocabulary. Unfortunately, it's been taken over and given a bad name.
So whether we're talking evolution, big E versus small e, or macroevolution versus microevolution, there really should be no problem. I'm a thoroughgoing six-day creationist. Mm-hmm. There should be no problem with me acknowledging that, yes, within species, animals adapt to their environment and to other factors over time. There's no big secret about this.
Right, no big secret, no big deal. In fact, as a six-day creationist, you would be the first to agree that you and I have, as well as our African-American friends and our Asian friends and et cetera, have all come from Adam and Eve. So we can observe right there that microevolution in action.
Okay. One tremendous insight early in your book is that Darwinists don't so much believe that they've proven as evolution per se, as much as they believe that they've disproven the alternative, being my position, divine creation.
That's right.
Explain that.
Well, if we go back to Darwin's day, that was the prevailing view, one form or another of creation. So if Darwin could disprove the prevailing ideology, then he would have opened the avenue for his theory, and that was the key. That is remains the key today. In science, we very rarely hear people talking about facts, except for things that are observed, like I observed Mars last night at a certain time at a certain elevation angle. But you know, in terms of overarching theories, like quantum mechanics or Newtonian physics or evolution, we don't speak of facts. These are theories. Interestingly enough, evolutionists do talk about their idea as a fact. And you wonder, gee, there's all kinds of problems with this idea. I could spend hours talking about the unexplained observables and the dilemmas with the theory of evolution. So why do they talk about it as a fact? Well, the one way that you can talk about something as a fact in science is to disprove all the alternatives. And that's what they feel they have done. Evolutionists consistently, if you read the literature carefully, they will argue that they have disproven the idea of divine creation. Of course, that brings up the question of what exactly do they mean by divine creation? But that's a whole other question. But they talk about, and Darwin's, one of his Darwin's favorite phrases in his book was the how inexplicable the theory of divine creation is. And in fact, Darwin made very many bold pronouncements in his book about God and about the way that God would create. And we normally think of Darwin as a scientist, as well as today's evolutionists are supposed to be scientists. But if you read their literature, it is amazing how often they make bold religious claims about God. So that's the way that you can talk about something being a fact. If you say, well, I know who God is. I know how God would create. He wouldn't do it this way. I know that. Therefore, evolution must be true. Now, you'll notice that this, in this case, evolution isn't really defined specifically. It is simply any naturalistic process, anything but creation. So it's the alter ego, the inverse of divine creation. And that's why the theory of evolution really doesn't have to be very well defined. They don't speak, you know, they have their theory of natural selection on that operates on biological variation, but they're not wedded to that. Darwin himself said, you know, we could toss that out the window. We don't need that. What we need is a naturalistic explanation. So really, that's the way I like to define evolution. It's really any naturalistic explanation of how the species got there. Now, if you think about it, that sounds awfully scientific. That sounds like a scientific theory, doesn't it? Any naturalistic mechanism. They're looking for natural means. Isn't that what science is all about? And so that's the argument you'll get from evolutionists is, well, we're just doing science. We're just looking for naturalistic mechanisms. There's a subtle problem with that argument, with that view, and that is, yes, it is a naturalistic means, but the motivation for looking for naturalistic means is a religious motivation. You see, scientific theories aren't just explanations. Scientific theories are explanations plus evidence. You have two parts to the theory, the explanation and the evidence. I could tell you that the universe evolved from vortices was created by vortices. That sounds awfully scientific, but it's not a scientific theory. Scientific theories have to have evidences, too, and there's no evidence that the universe came from vortices. So we have to have evidence and explanation. The evidences for evolution, at least all of the strong evidences, are religious in nature. They are about, well, this must have evolved because there's no other way it could have happened. And when they say there's no other way it could have happened, read between the lines, they mean God wouldn't have done it that way.
So you're saying that evolutionary science, as we have it now among us, really rules out of bounds and before any examination, any non-natural, and they get the privilege of defining that too, any non-natural explanation for events.
Right, but let me, Todd, let me clarify that just a little bit. They actually, I would argue to give them a little bit of a break here. They're actually not ruling out any non-natural explanations. It's rather they are considering specifically. They're specifically considering the possibility of divine creation, and specifically saying that doesn't meet the facts. We're not seeing that in nature. So it's not as though they're just simply anti-religious or anti-religious explanation, although that is now the upshot of it all. We now do see a definite bias and an argument that, gee, we can't even consider non-natural explanations. But what's interesting is that they started out by actually considering them. And Darwin and today's evolutionists consider that very seriously. And they will tell you straightforwardly, it simply is not possible. And like you said, they get the privilege of defining it, and that's the key, of course, is it doesn't come from them, though. Let me give them another break. Darwin was drawing upon the work of the Christians in his day and in generations prior to his. And those Christians, unfortunately, were dealing with what I would call a heretical view of God. They did try to explain the world as a harmonious, symmetrical, perfect rose garden, if you will. And I call it in my book, Darwin's Proof, I call it the paradigm of perfection. And you see this in people such as William Paley, who is often contrasted with Darwin. Paley was a generation before Darwin, and he's the man, they call him Mr. Design. He's the guy who argued that the species were designed. But embedded in his arguments was this idea that they all had to be perfect. And it wasn't just Paley. His whole genre was arguing that God, if God's going to do it, has to be perfect. Now, I'm going to be the last one to say it isn't perfect. I'll agree that it is perfect, but it's perfect in God's eyes and in God's sensibilities, not in our sensibilities.
Let's pick up on that when we come back from this break. That's a good insight to bear in mind, folks. When God created the world, he did say, it is good. Now he created man with an appendix. And the evolutionist is going to say, who might assume, well, if God creates something, it's got to be perfect. If God created it, it would be perfect. What's he doing with the appendix in there, the vestigial organ that seems to have no real function that we can discern past, present, or future? Well, then it's not perfect. And it must, therefore, not have been created by God, but arisen from some other natural process. It's a simplified explanation of where we are so far in our conversation with Cornelius Hunter. He is former senior vice president of Seagull Technology in Silicon Valley and author of the book Darwin's God and his new book, Darwin's Proof, The Triumph of Religion Over Science. We're talking about scientific, philosophical, and theological failures in Darwin's theory of evolution. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The Bush administration is asking the Supreme Court to consider for a second time a law designed to protect children from online pornography. Stuart Shepard tells us pro-family groups hope the high court listens.
The Child Online Protection Act was approved by Congress in 1998, but was stalled in the courts. Jan LaRue with Concerned Women for America explains what it would do if ever allowed to take effect.
It would require commercial pornographers operating on the World Wide Web to put those images behind an electronic brown wrapper, a perfectly reasonable, common sense constitutional law.
The Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled most of the law unconstitutional, but LaRue takes heart in the Supreme Court's recent favorable ruling concerning internet filtering at schools and libraries.
That gives us hope for this one, because here again, the focus is on children. And, you know, even the more liberal members of the court are not fans of children having access to pornography.
What we have here really in this dynamic age of ours is the intersection of the First Amendment and 21st century technology.
Brian Failing is with the American Family Association's Center for Law and Policy.
And the principles of the First Amendment can be maintained and sustained, but they have to be applied within the context of technology that, of course, the founders could have never envisioned.
He says it shows how critical it is to have a Justice Department that will fight for this kind of law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
In the appeal, the U.S. Solicitor General argued that children are unprotected from the, quote, harmful effects of the enormous amount of pornography on the World Wide Web. Jan LaRue says given the history of the case, there's a good chance the Supreme Court will grant the appeal. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Healing the Nation, one home at a time. Coming up on Focus on the Family, Dr. James Dobson and Counselor Dennis Rainey discuss how families can have great impact on the culture, but only if they are committed to God and each other first. Learn why reformation begins with reconciliation under your own roof. All on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Is there a severe famine of the gospel in many Christian churches today? Find out with the book, The Defense Never Rests, published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. The Defense Never Rests offers a powerful critique of American Christianity. 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Defense Never Rests, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August.
Sunday night on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss answering the moral skeptic. This is a very important conversation. We've got someone alongside Sunday night to help us walk through what we can't not know. It's the name of his newest book. The guest, Dr. Jay Bujaszewski of the University of Texas, will find out what it is that human beings can't not know, moral principles that we cannot deny, and how do we use this knowledge of moral principles we can't deny in answering the moral skeptic, live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Now, if you'd like to post a question or a comment for Dr. Jay Bujaszewski in advance of that Sunday night program, or during the program for that matter, go to our website, issuesetc.org. In fact, even if you're not going to post a question or a comment, go to our website. We've got great stuff on our website. Do you have something theological you've always wondered about? Predestination, liberalism, postmodernism, you name it. We got a search engine there. It's just called Search Issues, Etc. Click on it. Put in your thing. You will find article after article after article from Issues, Etc. Guests, the former host. There's one or two in there by me. You name it. It is a tremendous resource at our website, issuesetc.org. Now, if you want to go to the forum and post a question or a comment on the moral skeptic and answering their arguments, click on the What's New section right there near the top, and you'll find the Issues Etc. forum. Now, if you've got a question or a comment on Darwinian evolution and the philosophical, theological, and scientific answer to that broken down theory, not so much even a theory, says our guest, give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Cornelius Hunter is our guest. Cornelius, you propose a scenario that I think, does a great job of demonstrating the absurdity of the basic premise of Darwin's evolutionary theory. I would like to read it and then have you explain what it's doing. What if a spacecraft from a distant civilization came to the planet Earth and dazzled a crowd of people with its amazing maneuvers? As it speeds across the heavens, the crowds look on in unbelief. It is so advanced, it can even produce new spacecraft when needed. And when it lands, the people gather around to get a closer look at the awesome ship. They wonder where it came from and how it was constructed. Certainly it must be from a very advanced civilization. But then one man wonders if perhaps it had arisen spontaneously as a result of natural laws in the universe. The rest of the crowd makes no response, but their shuffling feet and sideways glances give away their suspicion that the man is not of sound mind. What are you trying to demonstrate here?
This is the bankruptcy of pagan thought. This is where it leads you. When you reject God and you decide what you think God could and could not do, you're left with absurdity, and this is the absurdity of the theory of evolution. I hope that the listeners don't ever think that there's something reasonable about evolution. And I'm talking about, of course, macroevolution, evolution with a big E, not microevolution. I hope that nobody gets confused and thinks, well, maybe it was just a minor mistake. You know, Darwin multiplied a couple of numbers wrong, got a wrong answer. We've got a couple of wrong assumptions, and we got to straighten this out. We got to explain to these folks that they've made some scientific mistakes. It isn't going to work that way, because that's not what this is all about. Evolution, by any objective, reasonable, scientific assessment, is simply absurd. And I spend a couple of chapters going over just scratching the surface, giving a few examples of biological complexity that just simply defies naturalistic explanations. There's many, many, many more examples. Volumes could be written on this stuff. And the idea that it came about naturally is just simply absurd. Now, the evolutionists, their response to this will be, wait a minute. Now, there's a possibility. I mean, you haven't disproven it, and that's actually true. We haven't disproven it. In fact, it's just about impossible to disprove things, overarching theories that can reach for any explanation. You can always speculate. You can always wave your hands and dream up possibilities, but that's not what science is about. If they want to be something like astrology, fine, that's different. But in science, we look for compelling explanations, reasonable explanations that jive with what we know about the natural world. We live in a universe where things don't fall together. It simply doesn't make sense that something like the DNA code, one of the most complex things we know of in cellular biology, just simply came together somehow. It just doesn't make sense. Now, maybe they have an explanation for it. Do they? The answer is no. There's raw speculation, a wild, really unfounded speculation. It just is not compelling at all. And this makes you wonder, what's going on here? Why do they consider it a fact? And, of course, that's the interesting thing. This is not considered to be a theory. It's considered to be a fact. So you have these two great contrasts. On the one hand, the evidence is frankly lousy, and the theory goes against everything we know about science. Yet on the other hand, it's considered to be a fact. So there's a very interesting chasm there, and that's, of course, the reason is because we have religious reasoning behind it all, dealing with the nature of God and the nature of creation and how we should juxtapose God and creation. And we really need to go to the years before Darwin to understand this. And so I'd like to give the evolutionists a little bit of a break here and to realize that they did not contrive this, and we need to clean house, and we need to think about where these ideas came from, because, in fact, we were talking about William Paley before the break, and William Paley, of course, is considered to be an Orthodox Christian, a man who advocated the idea of design, that God designed the species and so forth, which all sounds very good. But in fact, Paley advocated the idea that God wills and wishes for the happiness of his creatures. That was his entire system was founded on that. He had a proof for that. And his proof was non-scriptural. It was, I won't go over the details, but suffice it to say that it isn't very compelling. And when you look at verses in the Bible like Isaiah 45:7, which says God creates evil, or the first letter of the brother of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, I'm talking about James, the first chapter of his letter, where he says that we should be thankful for trials and tribulations. When Paul says that it has been granted to us to suffer on behalf of Christ in his letter to the Philippians, when the psalmist in Psalm 66 says that we praise Lord, we praise God because he let men ride over our heads, Amos in his prophecy says that if there's calamity in a city, will not the Lord have done it? I'm quoting here a variety of verses. The point is that God, we can't so simply paint smiling face, pie in the sky type theology. It's a little more complicated than that. Obviously, the crucifixion is the ultimate example of a terrible evil, but God used it for the greatest good. So what is evil? What is good? What does God do? It's a little more subtle than that. And in my book, Darwin's Proof, I get into this idea that nature and its species are part of general revelation. And scientists need to catch up with this idea. They can't be using arguments about God and against the doctrine of creation without first reckoning, at least, with the doctrine of general revelation, something the theologian has known all along.
And that being, in a nutshell, that God, it's basically what Paul lays out in the very opening chapters of Romans by way of indictment of all man's sin. He says, what can be known of God? Certain things, his divine majesty, other aspects of his nature in the abstract, are clearly evident from what he has made.
From what has been made, absolutely. And so when Jesus tells us that vipers are like false teachers, or false teachers are like vipers, and Solomon tells us that the fool is like the dog that returns to its vomit, and the psalmist tells us that the wise man is like a tree planted by the waters, I don't think these examples in nature just happen to be there, and that Jesus was thankful for the viper so that he could use it in his analogy, or Solomon just was thankful that the dog returned to his vomit. These are all things that laid in the mind of God before creation, as one 19th century theologian put it. These are not coincidences. So, in other words, in nature we have symbols, just like we have symbols in special revelation and foreshadowing in special revelation of ultimate truths. So, too, we have it in general revelation. So I argue against this paradigm of perfection, which, let's face it, came from the church. And we need to look at our own history and how we, in fact, lent credence to the idea of naturalistic explanations such as that which Darwin came up with. So we need to be, we need to understand, of course, that evolution is scientifically flawed. But more importantly, we need to understand what the motivation for evolution is, and that is this very subtle metaphysical argument that it just must have been naturalistic because it would not have been created this way. And then understand that this, in fact, came from the church in the centuries leading up to Darwin. Now, in my book, Darwin's Proof, I get into the idea that design, the theory of design, it's a good theory. I mean, there's no question. We look around us, the world was designed. It's obvious. But that doesn't explain everything. Obviously, that doesn't explain evil. And when people bring up the problem of evil, and when evolutionists bring up problems in design of creatures, which they perceive according to their sentiments, we need to point out the fallacy in this thinking that evil, according to our sensibility, is not something that God has never promised won't be there. And so what I argue for is that there's really only one explanation for our world that makes sense. Evolution doesn't make sense. Design fails to explain evil. And as an example of evil, I use the human brain, which is the most complex thing known in the universe. It's also the most evil thing known in the universe. Of course, I'm not talking about the spiritual realm with Satan, but in the material universe, the human brain is the most complex and the most evil. The only story we have to explain this, the only explanation that makes sense is, of course, the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. So, this whole expedition we've gone on with evolution, the whole 150 years here plus all the centuries leading up to it, are all basically showing us the absurdity and the bankruptcy of the other explanation. And the only explanation that makes sense is, of course, the scriptures.
We're talking about the failures of Darwin's theory of evolution, and by way of, I think, some really tremendous insight here, our guest Cornelius Hunter is saying much of the presuppositions about the nature of God that fueled Darwin's eventual rejection of a creator came from the errors of the church in his day. Cornelius Hunter is former senior vice president for Siegel Technology in Silicon Valley. He's authored two books, Darwin's God, and his latest is called Darwin's Proof, The Triumph of Religion Over Science. You point out early in the book as well that one of the biggest things that is often overlooked, even by people like me who want to argue against evolution, is Darwin's contention that evolution created evolution. Mm-hmm. Explain that to us.
Great. This is very interesting because it's being reinforced with findings right up to today. This brings us right up to the cutting edge research of today. It used to be thought that, yeah, we had these random mutations in the genome, and most of them were harmless or meaningless. Some were negative. Every once in a while, there's a positive one or a neutral one that later becomes positive. And that's the nature of evolution. It takes advantage of these random mutations. Well, now, as we're getting into the details, we're starting to look at the details. We're studying bacteria, and we're subjecting them to harmful conditions and seeing what they do. Something very interesting is emerging. We're looking at a very intricate, complex, adaptive machine. We're not finding that the mutations occur randomly throughout the genome. We're finding that there are hot spots. They tend to occur in certain places, and those certain places are well chosen because they tend to explore the meaningful design space. They change the bacteria in meaningful ways, or tend to at least. Also, certain bacteria amongst that population, when you subject it to harsh conditions, the mutational rate increases. So it's as though there was a message sent, hey folks, time to adapt, start changing. Thirdly, a small fraction of the population, I don't know, a few percent of those bacteria, are called hypermutators. They actually mutate at a much faster rate. So it's as though just in case these harmful conditions are so bad that we can't adapt quickly enough, we're going to preserve ourselves by having a few of us really go into some wild changes and see if there's something further away that'll solve our problem here to deal with this situation. So there is an intricate machine. This is not just a random, blind process. So so the upshot of all this is that if evolution is true, then what we have is evolution creating the bacteria and all the other species that have built into them these marvelous adaptation mechanisms, which now are claimed as evidence for evolution. It's really unfair, as you can see. The evolutionists cannot simply say, oh, gee, here's evidence for evolution, when in fact they can't explain the very mechanisms that they're claiming. Cornelius Van Til made the statement, the pagan has to sit on daddy's lap, or that the child has to sit on daddy's lap in order to slap his face. And it's the pagan has to leverage God's creation in order to deny creation. And he was, it's such a prescient observation he made so many years ago, that evolution is so often just kind of boldly rush in where fools fear to tread, and exploit some marvelous piece of creation as though it were evidence for evolution. It simply, makes no sense at all. What we're dealing with is evidence for creation and how God has built into these species its incredible capabilities.
We're talking with Cornelius Hunter about the failures of Darwin's theory of evolution. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment with about 10 minutes left in this conversation. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I had an experience at the St. Louis Zoo recently, Cornelius, where they opened the new Penguin and Puffin house. So I go in. I like penguins. They make me laugh. Them and chimps make me laugh. So I'm watching these birds. They have everything birds need to be birds. They've got feathers, they've got wings, they've got webbed feet, they've got beaks. They have the same kind of digestive system and reproductive system. They lay eggs. But these birds don't fly, they swim. And they swim as good as any fish in the world. They're adapted to a cold climate. And then I go into a into the insect house and I see butterflies that are more beautiful than anything, any artwork, flying around my head. And I say to my daughter, this is mind-boggling. There was a moth there that had a wingspan of probably about 14 inches. And it lives outside in its moth stage for 3 days.
Wow.
I said to my 11-year-old daughter, God not only is inscrutable as a creator, but he has a tremendous sense of humor. He makes fish that swim, birds that swim, fish that fly,
the elephant with a tiny little tail and the big huge nose.
And I'm thinking to myself, the evolutionist is going to look at this and say, these are our best examples for adaptation to the environment. These are our best examples because these birds should be flying, but they're swimming. And the answer is their environment is not conducive to flying, but it is, but it's too conducive to swimming. And I'm looking and saying, this is a marvelous creator.
It's so true, Todd. You know, I really get a kick out of this. That Darwin made this statement. He said, there is no greater anomaly of nature than a bird that cannot fly. Now, if you think about it, that is so metaphysically loaded and so absurd. There's no greater anomaly in nature than a bird that cannot fly. You realize a bird is a bird because we think of it as a bird. We classify these things. Now, there's nothing wrong with classification. That's great. We want to understand how you know creation is laid out. That's wonderful. But in fact, there are no clean, trivial boundaries. There are all kinds of exceptions. You have all sorts of species that fit into one category in one regard, but they fit into another category in another regard, simply because if you're designing things, you're not limited to any constraints. Think of a plane, and I give this example in Darwin's proof. Most planes have wheels. Some of them have pontoons, boat-shaped little elements instead of wheels, so they can land on the water. Is it a boat or is it a plane? Well, same thing with your penguin example. Penguins don't have to fly just because they have certain aspects that make them look like birds. And so this is a great evidence for evolutionists. As you said, they'll look at these things and they'll say, oh, no one ever would have designed this. This is a bird that can't fly. If we had a designer with any smarts, you know, he would have made all his birds so they could fly. Because after all, what's a bird for but flying? I mean, this whole thing is so metaphysical. It's funny.
Now, before we go, I have one final question. And our time is, we still have a little bit of time, but it's getting shorter. You make a point explicitly in the book, but you come return to this many times, and you already have really, in some ways, in our conversation so far, by saying that evolution simply explains too much. What do you mean by this?
Well, it can't. By the way, let me add to that at the end of Darwin's proof, I give an appendix full of arguments and responses. So it's kind of that. I've argued so much with evolutionists, I know every single argument, and so they're all in there. So they're a good resource for the listeners. But whenever evolutionists are confronted with a new species or a new design, they always can draw from one of several explanations. If it is optimally designed, or if it appears to be optimally designed, let me put it that way, they'll say, oh, okay, that's natural selection operating on biological variations, picking the best design because it had to survive, da-da-da-da-da, the classic argument. If it is appears to be suboptimally designed, a penguin that can't fly, they'll say, oh, okay, well, that's the blind aspect, the unguided aspect of natural evolution and natural selection. It doesn't know what it's doing. It's simply a bunch of natural forces bumbling along. The penguin is the outplay, the play of natural forces through the years, and so it really doesn't matter what is discovered. You can discover. I've had all sorts of things I thought would be a problem for evolution, or maybe even falsify evolution. And in fact, I had an ongoing discussion with an evolutionist friend, and he gave me an example of something that would falsify evolution. That very thing was discovered about a year later. I talk about this in Darwin's Proof. So I pointed that out to him, and of course he had an explanation for it. Well, you know, maybe that isn't functionless. It does function. And by the way, Todd, earlier in the show you mentioned the appendix being functionless, and in fact now we know that it does have a function. And so it's very hard to find things that don't have function. But evolutionists can explain, it explains too much, basically. There's nothing, to falsify evolution would be very difficult. I would argue impossible, but that's a philosophical argument. But it's just about anything. You know, in the 20th century, we found the most amazing thing. There was the explosion of molecular biology, something they didn't know about in Darwin's day. Now we know. In the cell is the most incredible machine you can imagine. I wish everyone understood it because it just would change everyone's thinking about the doctrine of creation. It's amazing. It's just a jaw-dropper. What did evolutionists do with it? They chalked it up as evidence for evolution. No matter, they can't explain how it actually came about. So, you know, it doesn't really matter what comes along because it's such an overarching theory. It really isn't committed to any particular explanation. It's only committed to the idea that the species could not have been created. They must have been naturally evolved. That leaves a wide variety of avenues of explanation open.
Cornelius Hunter, thank you so much for being our guest on Issues, Etc. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Cornelius Hunter is formerly Senior Vice President of Seagull Technology in Silicon Valley, and he's author of the book Darwin's God and his new book, Darwin's Proof, The Triumph of Religion Over Science. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend half of the last hour of the program today, the last live hour of Issues, Etc. this week, talking with Craig Parton, author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. Now, this is a series of conversations we're doing with Craig during this month of August. Yesterday, we talked a bit about defending the authority, the factuality of Scripture, and in particular, of the gospel itself, the account of Christ's life, death, resurrection, and ascension. Today, law, evidence, and the defense of the Christian faith with Craig Parton right after this break. Mike Horton joins us at 5:30, right in the last 25 minutes of the program. He's co-host of the national radio program called The White Horse Inn. He has written an article in the latest Modern Reformation magazine. It's called Pop Goes Postmodernism. One of the most brilliant and pithy things I've read from him, and this is a brilliant and pithy writer, Mike Horton. We'll talk to him about postmodernism and pop culture. He says, when it touches upon the church, postmodernism is really little more than just a slavish kowtowing to pop culture. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.